the departments they work in, where they eat lunch. They ponder how they've never bumped into each other before, and I know exactly what I'm looking at. Attraction. The undivided attention Henry used to pin on me is now flying out to someone else. It's unsettling. It's the biggest emotion I've felt all night, which says something given that the humiliation I endured not an hour ago was paralyzing. Then they exchange numbers, right in front of me. I curl my top lip as if they've begun obscenely making out on my lap. When Henry looks up from his phone and spots it, I transform my mouth into a humongous grin. I deserve a medal for the heroics it takes.
My taxi is here, I squeak.
Henry diverts his attention to the driver, sussing him out. Do you want me to come with you? I can do a round trip and get dropped back here if you're not comfortable going alone.
No, it's totally fine.
I'm walking backwards to the taxi.
You stay here.
I'm good. I'll let Sasha know about the Cheltenham thing, I say, before turning to make a dash for it. I hear Felicity asking,
What Cheltenham thing?
Behind me. I sink into the back seat of the car and close my eyes. Good night, the driver asks. The worst. He chuckles as he says, Oh, can't have been that bad. I perform the Heimlich manoeuvre on someone who wasn't choking. Then I got fired. He goes very quiet after that. As he puts the car in first, I take one last look at Henry. Felicity has now taken my spot on the bollard. They're both laughing. My life is completely on its head right now. I have a million worries, an entire career to salvage. The last thing I should be thinking about is a relationship that's been dead and buried for 4 years. So then why? As the taxi pulls away, and Henry peels his attention from Felicity across the car park to fix, intently, warmly, wholly, on me, do I smile?
Chapter 11. Henry. 5 years earlier. I walked out of the hospital at the crack of dawn, 14 hours after I'd arrived. Tiredness filled my brain with black, made my right eye a little twitchy. No sooner had I slung the strap of my backpack over my shoulder and jumped on my bike than my phone rang. I cursed under my breath, convinced it was the ward calling. Probably something I'd forgotten or an illegible patient note from the handover, but no. It was a name I never expected at this time. The only name I had the strength to smile for. Grace, I said. We've been dating a little over a month, grabbing hours between shifts, lunchtime picnics on the grass outside Winchester Cathedral, standing in the rain outside Le Bleu for a goodnight kiss. Ali called me a soppy git. I said I'd been called worse. Good morning, Grace said. She sounded like she'd been up for hours. In the background, I heard a blender. Is it? I am too tired to compute what a morning even is right now. Tough shift, she asked. 4 cardiac arrests, I said. 3 patients with norovirus, 2 leaking catheters, and a partridge in a pear tree, she said. I wouldn't have thought I'd be capable of laughter for hours after that hellish night, yet here I was, barely outside the double doors and already beaming. This girl. So I was about to do something incredibly impulsive, and I thought it would be right up your street, but it sounds like you've had a nightmare day already, so don't worry, get some sleep and I'll call you. Oh, hell no, I said. I put my backpack on the saddle of my bike. You cannot pique my curiosity like that and hang up. What are you planning? I'm going to look at something. She fell quiet. Penguins at Marwell Zoo? Stonehenge? The overflowing bins outside Waitrose? The options are endless. She hummed. A commercial property. A commercial property? I repeated, my sleepy head taking longer to catch on. Intriguing. One perfectly suited for a restaurant. Shit. Wow. That's huge. I know, am I crazy? Not at all. Her sigh floated down the line, relief palpable, as if it was exactly what she needed to hear. After we spoke about it on our first day, I haven't been able to get it out of my head. I've been drafting a business plan, researching financials. I really think... I'm rambling, sorry. I love it, I said. How driven you are, it's sexy as hell. I'm viewing it at 9, getting the train at 8:30. I looked at my watch, a little after 7. I'd better get changed then. No, she cried. Get some sleep, I'll report back. You seriously expect me to sleep? Now? No chance. You said 8:30, right? She paused for a moment. I knew she was deliberating whether or not to send me home to rest. She decided quickly. Platform 2, I'll get your ticket. After a cold shower and a large coffee, I made it to the station with only a few minutes to spare. It was a bright morning, an early spring zing in the air. I spotted her on the edge of the platform, hunting the crowds for me. She was wearing a long navy coat, tight at the waist, her fingers twisting nervously at the buttons. The smile she cracked when she saw me could have split the world in two. I went straight for a hug. I missed you, she said into my chest. It was the first time I'd seen her that week. I missed you, hence why I'm not comatose right now. I angled her mouth up for a kiss. She tasted like strawberries, which, thanks to our exertions in my kitchen on that first night together, was now the biggest turn-on. I was worried you'd crash when you got home. I nearly did, I said, but it wasn't true. I'd bounced around like a lost puppy, an unexpected date with Grace, a new addiction. I glanced at the departure board. So, where are we heading? Winley, Grace said. Dread pulsed through me. I noticeably stalled. Is that okay? She asked. I know it's not super glam, but... No, it's fine. Of course, it's been a long day. And it's only getting started. We grabbed 2 seats. For rush hour, it wasn't too busy. I watched the ticker tape on the roof of the carriage flash with our destination. Winley. An intermittent character in my life. The place I was born and lived for my first few years. Until I traded it out for Southampton, then Basingstoke, then Poole. The list went on, and unfortunately, so did my excuses not to come back here. I used to, quite a bit. I had a few friends from my first school that I'd kept in contact with, a couple of neighbours I'd played football and basketball with in the garage-lined alleyways. When I went to university, I made like-minded friends, people who were dedicated to medical careers, who blew off steam at the gym, who knew every physiological effect of alcohol and always called it a night at a sensible time. My friends in Winley weren't like that. They knew how to party, how to get so out of their heads messed up that morning was a forgotten consequence, which was exactly what I wanted. I would come here to remember, then drink to forget. I spent my first year of uni jumping between the two worlds until I got hit with a fail at the end of it. A note on my placement review said I came onto the ward one morning smelling of alcohol, which brought burning hot shame whenever I thought about it. And when my brothers heard about it, I received a stern talk about not messing up my future, about not blowing my best shot to escape our past and make something of myself. 2 ginormous men who looked like younger versions of my father, only with deeper scowls and bigger fists. And even if I knew they would never use them the way he did, I listened. Now I only came back here when the noise in my head got too loud. when I wanted to surround myself with people who expected nothing of me and drink until I found the off switch for my brain. Twice a year. Tops. Grace loaded the property listing on her phone. I was on the high street, a short stroll from the bandstand. It's central, parking close by but with great footfall potential, she said. I was hoping to find somewhere I could walk to, but Winchester is extortionate. Tell me about it, I said. I've been researching houses. With my budget, I'll struggle to buy a broom closet. I always thought I'd end up in a big city, London or New York, a big restaurant scene. Why didn't you? Grace smiled, all hints of regret disappearing. I wanted to stay close to Dottie. She glanced out the window as the fields gave way to a low brick skyline. Besides, it's so much more affordable down here. Would you ever consider moving over this way? Not if my life depended on it. Maybe, I said. I've seen plenty of incredible things in my lifetime. Open-heart surgeries, people fighting against all odds to beat infections that experienced medical professionals were certain would kill them. But the way Grace could make the most mundane, drab little space feel alive was like magic to me. She spun around the room. Greasy walls and a yellowed ceiling, bold 80s decor and a kitchen that looked like it should be condemned. But she didn't see any of that. She saw potential. A little firefly in the centre of a dark room. The estate agent, an older woman with pointy glasses who looked bored to tears, lazily explained the situation. That the owners of the cafe had been here for 40 years and were retiring. That would be available in 3 months' time. That she could put us in touch with her in-house financial advisor who could point Grace towards some very competitive lending for new startups. Which, as someone who has nightmares about falling into debt, felt like a daunting prospect. But Grace was sold. We can put the welcome desk right here, with this window letting in all the natural light. And then we can knock down that wall there and have an open kitchen where customers can see the cooking. Like a live-action kind of thing. I followed her in awe as she took pictures of the plumbing and gas lines, drawing a rough sketch of the layout. She was serious about this, I realised. This was no longer a little daydream. She had the will and the tenacity to actually make it happen. We thanked the estate agent. Grace said she'd ring within the next few days if she was interested. But my gut told me she'd have made a follow-up call before the day was out. It would need a lot of investment, she said, as we walked along the busy high street. Completely gut it, a new kitchen, brand new furniture. But I feel so excited. The thought of handing my notice into Jean Parry makes me feel like I'm floating. Can you... I didn't know how to say this without sounding rude, so I went for it. Can you afford to do this? I have some savings, and I've been researching financing. There's lots of grants for new startups. I think I'll qualify. She went quiet, as if contemplating something more. I'd need to provide a business plan to justify it. I'm thinking of making a vegetarian hotspot. My speciality and a real niche in the market. It's all starting to feel super possible. We made our way back to the train station. I kept my head down as we passed the pub I'd once considered my local, so I thought I was imagining it when I heard someone calling my name. Until Grace looked behind me, hearing it too. Henry Dunn! I turned to see Mia Baron. It felt like forever, but it must have been only 6 months since I last saw her, as I crawled out of her bed, naked, and hungover as hell. She smiled when I spotted her, galloping across the road to get to me, her long dark hair flicking over her shoulder. The faux leather of her jacket squeaked as we collided. She wrapped her arms around me, her phone and train ticket digging into the skin on my neck. As she pulled back, she tapped me on the shoulder. It's so good to see you! And you? I cut a look to Grace, who was watching the scene with interest. Mia hadn't even noticed her. How have you been? I've not seen you since that crazy night at mine. Oh my God, we were so wasted. I swear I haven't stopped thinking about when we... This is Grace, I said quickly, stomach tensing at where that was leading, a place Grace definitely didn't need to go. Oh, hey, Mia said. She turned back to me before Grace could say anything. I'm meeting up with all the old gang next week. You should totally come. I can't promise it won't get as messy as it did last time, though. I knew exactly what a messy night with Mia led to, and so did Grace, judging by the forlorn expression in her eyes. Well, Mia glanced at her phone. Ah, my train is leaving. Call me, okay? We'll hook up, she said as she backed away before disappearing onto the platform. We walked slowly, sure to put distance between us and Mia. I reached for Grace's hand. She didn't take it. Hook up. Hook up. Hook up. So, who was that? She said in an inauthentically bright way. I should probably have called it what it was and said she was a girl I used to sleep with. But after such an amazing morning, it felt a bit safer to play it down. Friend? I settled on. Am I right in thinking you have a lot of friends? I'm a popular man, Grace. What can I say? I teased, hoping she'd know that nothing about Mia felt serious. Ever. I wrapped my arm around her and we stepped onto the escalator in silence. The platform was busy. The 11 o'clock back to Winchester would be crowded. I was thinking about the best way to ensure our seats when Grace spoke up. Okay. I need to ask you something, she said. Shoot. She picked at her fingernails. Are you seeing other people? Because that definitely gave me the impression I might be one of many, and I told you outside Le Bleu that I didn't want to be messed around. And now I feel a bit stupid because I haven't been seeing anyone else, and if you're about to tell me you're hooking up with friends, I think I'm going to burst into tears. The panic tightened her expression. I quickly realised how bad what I'd said earlier sounded. Oh God, I said. I'm an idiot. No. Not at all. Her shoulders sunk. I'm not seeing anyone but you. Okay, she said in a way that made me think it was much better than okay. She tried to hide her smile. Mine was uncontainable. That girl, Mia, she said. I'm not going to call her, I said. I met her years ago, what feels like another lifetime. One, I'm desperate to forget. We have friends in common. It's something that's kind of lingered. Nothing serious. Never was. But you sleep together. Slept. I clarified. Past tense. She nodded, closing her eyes. I wanted to kiss away whatever images formed behind them, replace them with visions of us. In my kitchen, her bed, up against her front door, that one time we just could not wait. She kind of made me feel... Grace paused, collecting her thoughts. My ex, Jason. The guy I was with before you. He cheated on me. Shit, I said. Yeah. He met a woman at work, and I guess he wanted to see which of us he liked more, so he decided to screw us both until he made up his mind. Well, he sounds delightful, I said dryly. About as delightful as my first ever boyfriend. He wasn't exactly dating someone else. No, he just made up this big elaborate lie about being with his parents and then secretly met up with a girl he went to school with and slept with her. Grace, I couldn't fathom what went through these people's minds. So cruel. So I'm a bit delicate, for want of a better word. The announcer called our train as it appeared around the bend. And I really don't want to be that girl, the one who is needy and insecure, but I kind of am. We climbed aboard. I took her hand and made a beeline for the far end, the quieter carriage. We took our seats and she scrolled through her phone. I stared out the window, body thrumming with the need to sleep. But I kept my eyes open, thinking about our conversation. About Mia. Whether it would be better to tell her again I wasn't interested or to leave it. I'd never been in this position before. I'd never had anything to end. I just kept the numbers in my phone, a thumb swipe away from a quick thrill. I'd long been looking for an excuse to get out of all that. The old crowd, the one link to my past that stayed open. Maybe I'd found it. "You're quiet," Grace said. I gave her a weak smile. "I'm thinking about those guys you dated," I said. "I hate that they put you through that." "It wasn't the best," she replied. "But I feel you're different." "You are, aren't you?" This is what she meant by being needy, I realized. These subtle little yearnings for reassurance, for me to open my heart, to be in this as much as she was. If that was being needy, then I didn't know what everyone complained about. I turned to face her. She cut me off with a soft, sweet kiss on the lips. "You don't need to make promises, but please don't lie to me, okay?" "I won't," I said, and I meant it. The more serious Grace and I became, the more the lie I told about my parents on our first date ate at me. It was time to put on my big boy pants and be honest. "Which is why I should probably tell you," I said. A large man slumped into the seat beside us. A family with two little kids filled the seats in front, squabbling over the last packet of crisps. I couldn't do this now. Tell her the sordid details of my life up until this point with an audience. But when it came to telling the truth about my past, there was always an excuse. I knew from experience how shitty things got once people knew. How they stopped looking me in the eye. How they laced their voices with an irritating, sympathetic tone. The last thing I wanted was for Grace, the first and only person ever to look at me like I was special, like I could be the one to make up for all the dickheads that came before me, to see me for what I really was. Wounded. Broken. Unlovable. And so I decided to do what I did with all my other painful, complicated emotions. I pretended they didn't exist. Grace deserved someone as perfect as she was. And that's what I wanted to be. I was sick of carrying this baggage, the trauma of my messed up childhood. I wanted to erase it all, finally move on, let it go. So that's what I did. I chose to leave it in the past, to not bring any of it into my relationship with Grace. This was my clean slate. A brand new day one. "Tell me what?" Grace said. I pulled her closer to me. I kissed her forehead. "But there's no one else in the world I would traipse across the city for after a night shift."
Chapter 12. Grace. Now. "Being 25 again sucks." I almost hurl my laptop across the living room, but remember my weeping bank balance and stop myself at the last second. "Again?" Sasha's forehead creases. "Something you're not telling me?" I laugh it off and she chucks my blunder down to frustration when I show her my laptop screen. She lifts her glasses to the top of her head and reads the email on the screen. "We regret to inform you that the position has already been filled," she tuts. It's been 6 weeks since my public firing, and the job prospects are, to be frank, bleak as hell. You'd think having foresight into the future would give me a competitive edge, but my CV is pretty barren. How am I supposed to convey that I am a skilled chef when on paper I have only a few years of kitchen experience behind me, the most impressive of which ended in spectacular embarrassment and no reference? "And yet the job advert remains online," I say. "They all want experience, and yet no one is willing to hire anyone without experience so that they can actually get the experience." Sasha returns her attention to her work. She's stretched across the carpet, piles of small font legal papers before her. Her passion and tenacity give an extra sting to my unemployment. "I don't know why you don't pursue private catering," she says. "You were willing to make a go of it a few months ago, said it was the start of your business empire." My business empire? Wow, that's a phrase I haven't heard in a while. Not since I was convinced I would become the next Nigella Lawson or Celine Duval. The version of me who had faith in herself, who believed she could take on the cruel, hard world. I'd take employee of the month at Burger King right now. "I'm trying to keep my feet on the ground. Be realistic," I say. "I want a steady job to gain more experience, with terrible hours and crap pay. That'll do nicely." We fall into a natural working rhythm. Me deleting and retyping the same bullet point. Sasha formulating a strategy to change people's lives for the better. Apples and oranges. Eventually, Sasha puts down her pen and stretches her arms into the air until her back clicks. "God, I can't wait for tomorrow. I so need a day to let loose. Have you decided what you're wearing?" The races. My stomach feels like it's being pummeled with rocks. "I'm probably going to give it a miss," I say.
"No, absolutely not," Sasha shouts.
My laptop jumps an inch in the air.
"I already paid Ali for your ticket. You have to come."
A day of third wheeling isn't exactly my thing. She'd already told me who was coming. Ali and her not-boyfriend, Marcus. Sasha and Roman. Henry and Felicity. Apparently, they've really hit it off. This will be their third date. The prospect of watching them spend the afternoon lusting over each other, all flirty foreplay and longing glances, is like being invited to have my heartstrings slashed with a chainsaw and paying for the privilege. Sasha can't argue with my logic, but she does anyway.
"It won't be coupley, I promise. Roman and I aren't like that, and I know Ali is more excited to hang with me than she is Marcus. It will be a girly day. The boys will be in the background."
I had Sasha pegged for a lot of things. Intelligent, sophisticated, hilarious, but not a liar. It's the next morning, and my arm has been well and truly twisted. I'm wearing a cream lace dress and a fascinator that looks like a prototype for an alien spaceship. I wore the same outfit before, the first time I went to Cheltenham. If I squint my eyes and clear my mind, as I step onto the coach and look at Henry, I can pretend for a moment that it's only us. That we're besotted with each other. That we're about to live one of my favourite days of my life so far. But then Felicity stands, blocking my view, leaning close for a hug hello.
"You look gorgeous," she says. "I'm so glad you came."
Henry doesn't stand to greet me, just offers a small smile. He's wearing a cream Italian suit, stylish black sunglasses rest on his half-open shirt. His dark hair has a slight summery wave to it, and all I can think about is how smooth it feels to run my fingers through, how it smells like divine pepper and wood. I am certain this entire coach can see me humming with lust.
"Ooh, look who's matchy-matchy,"
Felicity giggles, pointing between mine and Henry's complimentary neutral outfits. "I didn't know there was a colour scheme." If I look at him again, I'm going to physically swoon.
"Great minds,"
I say, ungracefully falling into the seats behind them as the coach moves off. Two seats back are Ali and Marcus, whose slurpy kisses are making my empty stomach queasy, And in the gaps between the headrests, I can see Henry and Felicity making doe eyes between each whispered word. The empty seat beside me throbs with nothingness. Sasha gives me a double thumbs up from the front of the coach. All I can do is roll my eyes and laugh at the madness of it all. We're not allowed to take food or drink into the race course, so we set up a little picnic area to the side of the grounds. We graze on plastic-wrapped supermarket picky bits. Scotch eggs, sandwiches, and share bags of crisps. And I can't help thinking I could have put on a better spread myself. Nutritious and delicious, without a preservative in sight. But two things would need to occur for that to have happened. I'd need the money for the supplies, and I'd need the will and energy to cook. I have cooked since the glitch, at Le Bleu, and also I've obviously kept myself fed, if you can call stabbing the film of microwave meals and peeling the skin of a banana cooking. But whereas I used to spend entire days tasting recipes, trying out new techniques, honing my craft, now, every time I even think about turning on the oven or breaking out the rolling pin, I stop myself. The niggling, whiny little voice in my ear tells me it's a waste of time, that I'll never be good enough, that I need to find another passion. The voice has always been there, weirdly similar to my mother's, like she's doing a bad impression of the devil after sucking on a helium balloon. I never gave the voice space before. I had the determination and, most importantly, the hope to shut it down the minute it started. But since I lost the restaurant, I've let it take centre stage. And now it's got squatters' rights. As we eat, the betting guides are passed around, everyone picking their winners on nothing more than names. Marcus thinks he has a foolproof method of betting on every single horse, but really, I'm the one with the winning edge. Felicity circles a couple of horses she likes the names of. Violent Delight and Bloody Mary, then hands the booklet to me. I flick straight to the final race of the day, the one all the bookies and punters are buzzing for. As soon as I see it, I freeze. The lucky one. The horse I named my restaurant after. I knew it would be here, but seeing it in black and white sends a buzz under my skin. One little bet could change everything.
You having a flutter? Ali asks, peering over my shoulder.
Oh no, too rich for my blood, I say. I hand her the booklet and lift my plastic cup of Prosecco. The last thing I want is to draw attention to myself with a dramatic fool's bet. I'll need to keep this quiet. I'm here for the food and drink. She clinks her cup against mine. My kind of girl. Once we're through the gates, everyone peels off into their natural pairs. They head in different directions. To the bar, to the toilets, to the bookies. I hang back, staring at the long course before me, in a state of disbelief. Being here again, it's all too much to comprehend. What the hell is happening? I whisper to myself.
So this is called the grandstand.
A tall, fair-haired man says to me, pointing up at the seating that towers behind us. And that's where people usually go to look out over this long green thing. Grass, he says, speaking slowly and enunciating every syllable. That's the race course. In a minute, you'll spot some horses. Four legs, hairy, big muscles. They'll be running, but don't panic. That's exactly what they're supposed to do. I narrow my eyes at him. He is dressed well, in a light suit and tie. He has a mischievous grin and friendly blue eyes. At my confusion, he erupts into laughter. What? You weren't talking to me? Despite myself, I laugh too. Thank you for your detailed analysis. I look at him expectantly. Rhys, he says. Rhys, I repeat. Would you believe me if I said I've actually been here before? Then you're an expert. He watches me for a second, eyes lingering on the bare skin above my cleavage. Grace, I say, and definitely not an expert. I've picked a horse, but I have absolutely no idea what to do. Ah, he says, the intimidation of the bookies. He points to the row of betting stands to the side of the concourse, swarmed with people. There are men in flat caps screaming, a ticker tape of horses and numbers that change every few seconds. They look tough, but trust me, They're only after one thing, he says.
All my money?
World peace, he says, as if to mean, what else? I cackle a laugh, finally looking into his eyes. My stomach does a little flip. Come on, I'll show you the ropes. Rhys takes me by the hand and unwittingly walks me straight to the ticket desk Henry and Felicity are standing at. With my back to them, I take my bank card from my purse. I don't want to step on your toes, Rhys says as we move forward in the crowd. But you know how much you want to bet. How the odds work, right? Yep, I tell him, when the answer is a little further from the truth. I know how much I have in my bank account, how much I need to pay my rent and bills, to feed myself. That's all I'm thinking about. Awesome. Rhys puts his hand on the small of my back, ushering me forward in the queue. It's all bustle, with bodies moving and shouting, no discernible order. So very un-British. This guy is probably going to yell at you, and I'm going to yell back, and then you'll pay him and he'll shut right up, Rhys says with a little smirk. Is everything okay? Henry's voice comes from behind, a little closer than I expected. Grace? I look over my shoulder, attention snagging on his hand entwined with Felicity's. Yep, all good, mate. Rhys barely looks at him. He keeps his eyes fixed on me, and the open betting guide he's flicked onto the last page. The lucky one is beaming at me. So what name am I screaming? And don't say Grace. I tried to hide my blush with a laugh. This one. I point to the name in the guide. £150. Nerves make my heart beat faster. Once this payment comes out, I'll be left with 34 pence. Rhys does a double take, pulling the pages closer to his face as if he's reading it wrong. You know that horse is a lost hope, yeah? It's the racing equivalent of a seat filler. What can I say? I love an underdog. You're about to be the bookie's favourite person. Rhys straightens in preparation, and as promised, there's lots of yelling, lots of confusion on my part, and then I swipe my card in return for a little white betting slip. My meal ticket for financial freedom. For a few months, at least. Felicity glances at the stub in my hands. That horse is 100-1, she cries. I suddenly realise there's no rational way to explain this, so I play dumb. Is it? Rhys is laughing. Damn, girl, you better hope this one lives up to its name. Why? What one did you pick? Henry asks. The lucky one. We lock eyes as I say it, and the strength of his gaze threatens to suck the air out of me. I flash back to this time in the before, his arm around my waist as we watch the winner cross the line, the stub in my hand printed with the name of the horse everyone swore was going to win. Practically a sure thing, the bookie had told me. The lucky one? I wailed, as my horse trudged over the line in last place. How did that happen? I think that's what they call an upset. Henry glanced behind him from the cries of disappointment. I wasn't the only one who'd wasted a bet. This whole day has been an upset. I flicked through our collection of losing stubs. Between us, we were down almost £50. We are most definitely not the lucky ones. I laughed because it didn't matter. Not really. We'd enjoyed ourselves. As the crowds dispersed, everyone making their way to the exits or the bars, it was only Henry and me, on a little grassy mound, overlooking the entire racecourse. The sun was setting behind us, illuminating our silhouettes in dreamy shades of gold. Oh, I don't know about that, he says, his hands finding my back, pulling us together hip to hip. I believe you make your own luck. He smiled before he kissed me. We must have looked picture postcard adorable, because a group of girls awed at us when they walked by. Henry leaned back to see all of me, and my heart soared. He ran his fingers over my temple, tucking a loose curl behind my ear. We're definitely the lucky ones, Grace, he said. It was the first time I'd ever felt like anything was possible. That my wildest dreams were a small step from being reality. A dose of his optimism straight to my heart. We are, I agreed. And I decided, in that moment,
he was right. That I'd make my own luck. That the restaurant I'd signed a lease for finally had a name. The Lucky One. I'm pulled back to the current moment, and away from Henry's confused gaze, by a man with a giant camera on his shoulder, tugging Reese's arm. "I'll be 2 minutes," Reese tells the man, before turning to me. "So I'm technically at work here," he says, flashing me his pass marked press. "Sports correspondent. I'm going to be all over getting vox pops for a report, but can I get your number? I'd love to meet up for that final race. See if you can make a miracle happen." He winks, and I instantly understand how he managed to land a job in television. He has a natural charisma, and he's really cute. "Yeah, sure," I say, with a little too much enthusiasm. I type my number into his phone, oddly aware of Henry's eyes on me, and at first I think it must be in my mind, because he has given me no reason to think this would make him jealous. Then Felicity grips Henry's arm tighter, and I know she sees it too. The way Henry's jaw works back and forth, the way his eyes narrow to analyze the situation unfolding. I say goodbye to Reese and put my betting slip into my purse. The three of us stand there awkwardly. Henry is still staring at me, a vacant look on his face. The last thing I want is for Felicity to feel uncomfortable. "Henry, what do you think about getting another round of drinks?" I suggest. He nods, as if awakening from a daydream. "Absolutely," he replies, before kissing Felicity's cheek and making his way to the bar. A queue is beginning to form at the bookies, and so we move to the edge of the course. Felicity smiles and nervously adjusts her blazer. I really don't want her to see me as any type of competition for his affections, because I'm absolutely not. We chat for a little while. She tells me how busy she's been at work, how short-staffed her team is, how badly she needs a day off. We spot the rest of our group on the far lawn, trying unsuccessfully to blag entry to the fancy VIP enclosures. We give them a wave. As Felicity turns back to me, her necklace catches in the sunlight. "That's so striking," I say. "It's a unique, deep red pendant."
"Oh, thank you," Felicity replies, twisting the gold chain in her fingers. "It's blood."
I blink a few times, checking the roaring crowd hasn't caused me to mishear. "Like a blood... diamond? Ruby?" I ask. I think of Dottie's crystals, but it doesn't look like any I've seen.
"No," she says with a smile. "Real blood. My dad's."
There's a moment when she stares into my eyes, and I feel a little on edge. I tell myself I'm being silly. She must mean that it's a commemorative piece. "Oh, I'm so sorry. When did he pass?"
"What? No," she laughs. "I have all my loved ones' blood in miniature vials. I alternate them accordingly. You see, my dad is a huge fan of the races, and so even though he couldn't be here today, I wanted a part of him with me. Tomorrow, I'm taking my sister to the outlet mall near Reading. She loves to look at the Hermes handbags."
She laughs again, and at first I think she's kidding. Then she whips out her phone and shows me a picture of 10 little vials with clip-on attachments, pointing to each one and telling me who they belong to. The last one she says somewhat wistfully, "Antonio, an ex-lover for sure." I clear my throat. "Remind me what you said you do at the hospital, Felicity?"
"Hematology," she replies.
"Of course." Henry reappears with a bottle of Prosecco. He must see my bemused expression because he glances between Felicity and me. "What are we talking about?"
"Nothing," I say quickly.
I pinch my lips between my teeth to contain a nervous laugh. "Absolutely nothing." His brows knit together, relaxing only when Felicity kisses him. Someone should probably tell Henry he's dating the modern-day Dracula, but it sure as hell isn't going to be me. True to his word, Reese texts and finds me minutes before the starting gun of the last race. I say a temporary goodbye to Sasha and the group and meet him in the press area. He's a little more dishevelled now, with his tie loose and top button undone. But he looks so thoroughly pleased to see me, I ignore the beads of sweat gathering under his collar. When the race starts and the lucky one falls into last position, I grip onto Reese. There's so much cheering, so many heads in front of me. It's hard to see what's happening.
but Rhys takes the loss as a foregone conclusion.
Ooh, bad luck, Grace, he says.
But it's not over yet. The lucky one is coming from behind, stealing the space, closing the gap. Within 10 seconds, he's darted ahead, like a super booster has been activated, set off at the perfect moment to take him all the way.
He's over the line.
And it's close, but not close enough that there is any mistake in who has taken the crown.
I step back.
I knew this was going to happen.
But, oh my God.
The adrenaline makes my teeth chatter, my fingertips sting. I've won £15,000. The crowd don't go wild. In fact, most people wail and moan. Tickets are thrown on the floor, curse words fly. It's an upset for the record books, a result even seasoned bookies didn't predict.
Holy shit!
Rhys shouts. He clicks his fingers at his cameraman behind him, and before I know what's happening, the red light is on me, the lens pointed right at my face.
Grace, you bet big on the lucky one, the underdog in the final race here at Cheltenham. What made you do it?
My stomach tenses. So much for being discreet. I look at Rhys, who is urging me to talk with a rolling hand motion.
Say anything but the truth. Say anything but the truth.
I had a hunch?
I wish I had your hunches, a drunk man behind me slurs. Absolute bollocks, total fix.
Rhys cuts the recording, not quite the interview he was hoping for. He begins saying something about texting me to organise a date, making a point of telling me he would have suggested it, win or lose. And I agree, while being shoulder bumped and knocked as the 1,000-person crowd swarms from the racecourse back to the grandstand. I need some space. I need to let this sink in. And most importantly, when it comes to me and money, I need to make a plan. Rhys continues working, and I find the one quiet place on the whole site, the restaurant. Service has finished and staff move calmly to clear down the space, ready for the next day. The soothing sounds of stacking cutlery and a whirring dishwasher ease the chaos in my mind. I take a seat at the empty bar. An idle barman hands me a glass of water. It's 5 minutes later when Henry finds me. He leans next to me at the bar, an elbow on the wood, his hand on his temple. It's the first time I've taken my attention from my winning slip. He stares at me expectantly, mouth in a tight line, eyebrows hitched. I instantly know what he's thinking.
So you found out about the blood thing?
Yeah, he says, unamused. She told me she had a lovely in-depth conversation about it with... Oh, wait, who was it again? Oh, yeah, you. He's trying not to laugh now. It wasn't my place to bring it up, I say. I rolled up my shirt sleeves and she told me I had the veins of an ox. I glance at where his elbow meets his sleeve, follow the lines to his wrists, the hard curve of his forearm. Every single inch of this man is perfection.
That'll teach you to do something so obscene in public.
I thought she was going to start biting me in front of thousands of people. I look behind me. Where is she now? Well, after she introduced me to her family of blood samples, I told her I didn't think it was going to work out between us, and she said she was going home.
To her crypt?
I say. Someone's got to keep the bats company. He eyes the restaurant door, as if she might appear any second. Why'd you come all the way up here? He looks at me as if the answer is obvious.
In case she stayed. This is the only place on the premises likely to have garlic.
He smiles at me again. And when our eyes connect, all I can think is,
God, I've missed this. Missed us.
My old feelings flutter inside me, resurrected by a simple smile. Utterly uncontainable. I didn't see the last race. What with the breakup and all. How'd you do? He asks. With the horse or Rhys? He sucks in a small breath. The horse. You get a win?
A little one,
I say, sliding my winning slip over to him.
A little one?
He splutters over his words.
Jesus Grace, you won 15 grand.
He pulls me in for a congratulatory hug, my face falling perfectly into the space between his neck and chest. I breathe him in until my knees begin to fold. He released me to look at the slip again.
The lucky one.
100 to 1. How the hell did you manage that?
He's waiting expectantly for an answer, but I'm so taken aback by the way his cologne invigorates my senses that I almost tell him the truth. That I've lived this day before. That I knew the winner before it happened. That you're the love of my life and you'll never even know it. I remember what I said to Reese. Just a hunch.
A hunch? He scoffs. You'd have had better odds running the race yourself.
What can I say? I had a gut feeling. Whatever you want to call it. He nods, with undisguised interest.
Good for you.
What are you going to do with it?
I've no idea, I say. I feel like I shouldn't waste it. That I should put it to good use.
Buy a one-way ticket to Sydney. Start a whole new life. His face snaps to mine.
Sydney?
I can't say it's something I've considered seriously. But with the job hunting going miserably, the background thought has started to itch to the forefront. The perfect way to ensure I completely change my future.
Or Rome, or Tokyo. Somewhere with a vibrant restaurant scene, I say.
You'd really walk away?
Leave everyone? He asks.
I know he doesn't mean himself. He means the family he's imagining I have. The loving parents who would weep at the airport for me. They probably wouldn't even notice I'd gone.
Yeah, who am I kidding? I laugh it off with a wave. I'm lying to myself if I think I can leave Dottie.
He looks so relieved he almost forgets to continue the conversation.
Dottie?
My grandmother. He nods. The sounds of staff cleaning up clink around us. We should probably try and find the others. But neither of us moves.
I lie to myself sometimes too, he says, sounding almost nervous.
Like when I ask out pretty girls in hotel car parks and when they begin to say no, I get embarrassed and do something awful and tell them I meant it platonically. Our eyes meet again, and it's not so much surprise as a mutual wall falling away. An open space now, waiting for me to walk through.
I'm sorry, he adds. I could tell it made you feel bad, and it was total chicken shit of me to do.
It's fine, I say. No big deal.
It is to me, he says, and I can promise, if I work up the courage to ask you out again, no matter the answer, I'll say no.
It blurts out of me, a defensiveness that's unwarranted in his eyes and utterly essential in mine.
Oh, he says.
It's not personal. He winces skeptically, and I push forward, no idea if I'm about to make this worse. I've been dating non-stop since I turned 18, and it's been nothing but disastrous. Wild highs followed by crushing lows. But it's taught me a lot. About what I need, what I don't. And right now, what I need is to be single. To focus on my career, figure out what I'm going to do with my life.
I get that, Henry says. If it weren't for the disappointment in his eyes, I would think he wasn't fazed at all.
Call it another hunch, I say, with a smile.
Henry closes his eyes for a lingering moment, then fixes them on me.
I have a hunch too, he says.
What's that?
He looks at my mouth. That kissing you would be fucking electric.
There you are, we've been looking for you for ages.
Ali slides between us, raising a palm to the bartender, ordering another bottle of bubbles. I won £30 and I'm spending it on a round. I know, call me generous, right? She laughs before Marcus, Sasha and Roman appear too, and then there's four bodies between me and Henry, but we're still looking at each other. I'm almost certain he overhears me say, you have no idea.
Chapter 13. Henry, 5 years earlier. By the end of spring, I knew I was in love with her. I admitted it to myself daily, but not to her. I had this notion that the timing needed to be perfect. Flowers, candles, some overly drawn-out treasure hunt with me at the end in a three-piece suit. I knew it didn't need all those things, not really. I only needed courage. But the only time I'd ever said those words before was to my parents. A peace offering. A pledge of innocence. The words felt tainted, somehow. A precursor to disaster. That's what I'd always thought, anyway. Never having come close to feeling the real thing. But with Grace, it was all so simple. She'd put her hand under my chin as she spoon-fed me mouthfuls of something new she was cooking and do this adorable little happy dance as I dived in for more. I'd noticed the crinkles in the corners of her eyes as she smiled, so breathtakingly beautiful, and think, how could anyone not fall in love with you? Or we'd be huddled together under a too low showerhead, my backside burning, shoulders like ice. Grace would slather body wash across my chest, down my arms, then catch my gaze in a way that would make time stand still, with suspended water glistening between our faces. And I'd think, this right here is love. Or I'd curl up next to her on a sofa. She'd be reading. I'd be fussing over a medical journal, the television low in the background. She'd tuck her ice-cold feet under my thigh, and even though it was uncomfortable, the thought of complaining wouldn't even cross my mind. My body made her warm. Grace needed me. And somehow that was everything. It was love. Of course. What else? Just tell her, Mikkel said to me one early shift. We rounded the nurse's station. He picked up a bedpan and a pair of sterile gloves. I wheeled the blood pressure monitor. We'd worked together for 3 years at that point, having met fresh out of university, bricking it to finally be qualified cardiac nurses. It was a friendship built on short, sleep-deprived moments. 2 minutes in the locker room, 30 seconds grabbing a few bites of a sandwich, a slow walk to the hospital bike shed as the sun came up. Despite this, he was undoubtedly one of my best mates. Only someone you've worked alongside can possibly understand the agony and ecstasy of nursing. We made our way onto the ward. I want to, I said, but what if it's too soon? What if she doesn't say it back? A deep, dark memory hit me. Me at 8 years old. Hungry, cold, tired, and begging my parents not to leave. Screaming that I loved them, hoping it would stop the chaos, that those words would make everything better. And they didn't. For the longest time, I despised